Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Cherie. How are you?
Hi, this is Miriam.
Hi, Miriam.
Hi.
Who else is on the line? Jesse?
Jesse, right.
Oh, okay. Where are you guys from?
I'm from New York.
Okay, me too. Yeah, I'm in the Bronx.
Oh, okay, great. And
where are
you in New York? Jeffrey? In Long Island.
Ah.
Yeah. And where are you from, Jeffrey?
Florida.
Oh, that sounds very good right about now. Well, how warm is it?
I didn't want to say anything to rub it in. But
Yeah. What part of Florida are you from?
The Ocala, which is about 90 miles north of Tampa.
Mm.
Oh, got it.
Okay. Send us some sun.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't sunny down here today, but at least it was warm.
Okay.
Oh, hi, everyone. This is Paulette, and I'm in New Mexico.
Hi, everybody. This is Dave. Welcome to the Art and Science of Coaching Wellness. I'm glad you began to introduce yourselves. I'm not sure you saw my email. I just got a final list of everyone who had signed on just very recently. Two questions, mm-hmm. and feel free to respond right now if you'd like, or if you'd like to fire back an email. One is, if we were to sit down face-to-face right now, what is the primary question, the most important question you have about this topic that you'd like to ask? And secondly, 4 weeks from now, if you walk away saying this is one of the most useful and enjoyable seminar series you've ever attended, what would you walk away with? Any responses to either of those, just right off the cuff? Paulette from New Mexico, you've already warmed up. What's any responses?
Well, I've already kind of looked in, and I'm already starting my business as being a wellness coach, or I'm calling myself a wellness guide. And I'm working with people with chronic pain and illness. So, you know, that's a pretty big thing. So it's, you know, walking away with something that would help me help them better.
Okay. Got it. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And this kind of input on the front end is especially helpful to me to shape some of the focus and the content. I have some things prepared, but I want to be sure that we cover the things that are of specific interest to you. So other responses to either of those questions, most important thing or what you'd like to walk away with?
Hi. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
For me, I guess
this
similar. This is Cherie. I'm in New York.
Thanks. Go ahead.
I believe a real understanding of the methodology. Because I too have a coaching background, and I'm also a licensed therapist. And one of the things that people want to know, besides can you help me, is how are you going to help me? And I just want to have a more clear understanding of, this is the program that I'm presenting. Of course, it'll be tailor-made, but this is how I envision helping you. This is the way we're going to work together to achieve the goals that you have for yourself in your life.
Okay, yeah, great question. Just to check with each of you to be sure that you've downloaded and printed the outline and the workbook from the page that you were directed to. I resent that in the email. It's the same page that has the ports for each of the recordings of the session for online playback. You'll see in the workbook, and we're going to cover in seminars 2 through 4, the roadmap system. It's a 7-step system for understanding a wellness story and for revising one. So I think that will be important, and it will be a kind of a how-to, and there are some exercises. I would encourage each of you to do the exercises yourself in the workbook for the upcoming seminar that we do. Also, there's a white paper on the homepage of my website, Mentor Path, on the bottom right, that is one that helps to, or that addresses distinguishing therapy from coaching. As most of you probably know, I practiced psychiatry, psychoanalysis for 25 years, was clinical professor at Baylor College of Medicine, did a wholesale transition over a decade ago to mentor coaching, so I'm very familiar with the distinctions of the two, and in that paper may be helpful to you to distinguish that, and it's particularly useful in the area of wellness and to look at what we do uniquely as professional coaches in the whole area of wellness, and that's exactly what we'll be talking about and how to apply the tools and methods and principles of coaching to help someone develop a new wellness story. So great. There was also someone who spoke at the same time as Cherie. Would you?
Yeah, this is Miriam. I'm from New York. Hi. So I've been a personal coach and a business coach for about 12 years. I was really, I want to walk away with a clear understanding of what wellness coaching is. And I wondered if work-life balance would be considered under that umbrella.
I think it will, and I think you'll see some application as we proceed, and that's a great question, and we're going to look specifically at some of the things, at least from my point of view, that we do in wellness coaching. And again, everything that you hear from me should be prefaced by, well, from my point of view, because we'll talk about a number of things and perspectives and applications, and you'll hear how my approach is to integrate the mind and brain sciences, especially psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, with strategic coaching to create an even more effective way of understanding and of making change that lasts. And we'll talk about all of that in the application in a practical way. I'm not, because you won't be educating your clients about anything or simply giving information. And each of you know, if information were enough, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd have a lot of money saved for the future, and there'd be a lot of librarians that would be close to billionaires. So information is not enough, and that's not what we do. We're not purveyors of information. But the reason I call myself mentor coach is that allows me to get away with doing things other than just asking powerful questions so that we truly collaborate about reaching the client's goals and developing strategies that are effective in doing that and taking aspects of how the mind and brain work into account, because so many of the methods to affect change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. So that makes it a little tough.
Okay, I just want to just add one thing. I'm hearing a very high-pitched hum. Is that just me, and maybe I should call back in, or is anybody else hearing
that? I don't hear a hum, but when I do the presentation portion, I'm going to go on lecture mode. If anyone has a cell phone or a computer phone, if you would mute, because the telephone, the cell phone and the computer phone don't do well with the bridge line. The technology, surprisingly, is not advanced enough, but I'll go on lecture mode in just a moment as soon as we get into the material. And I'll ask each of you to manage the background noise and the hum if you hear it. I don't. Be on mute, which is, if you don't have a headset with a little toggle switch for off and on for mute, mute is *6. And remember to come back when you're ready to talk to do *6 again to unmute. So I'll ask you to manage background noise.
Okay, but if I wanted to call back in, if that sound still exists, I'd be able to do that, right?
Exactly.
I'll get back into the class. Okay.
Exactly.
Great, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I also do hear the hum, too, so.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's individualized.
Okay. See what it does with the lecture mode, and if it's a problem, I'll check with the Telebridge group.
Okay.
Any other quick questions or comments or answers to these two questions that you'd like to offer before we begin? Thank you for your openness and quickness to respond. I appreciate that. It makes a difference. Any other responses?
Yes, this is Megan calling. I didn't introduce myself before. I'm out of Tennessee. But I guess my main question, and you kind of addressed it just now, but my main question is helping clients who have reached so many dead ends with, you know, personal wellness goals, helping them get over the negativity, you know, through so many, oh, I've tried that. Helping them to get over the dead end that they have created for themselves to actually get well and be healthy.
That's exactly where we earn our money. And that's mm-hmm. the challenge, and I think it's a really important question, and we will definitely address that and look at it, especially how the mind and brain works in that regard.
Yeah.
So it's a great question. So
I have just one other thing. This is Carolyn Wilkins. I'm in California.
Welcome.
And
go ahead.
I'm a minister, so I'm a spiritual coach as well as a business and life coach. And so my question is similar, but just with a little twist. So I work with people on a spiritual basis and emotional basis. And in times such as this, where there's a lot of disappointment and frustration and anger, regardless of who people voted for or what their commitment is, it seems like everyone is angry. And I'm wondering where you classify where anger and wellness are placed. I know it's an emotion. I know it can be taken from intellectual standpoint, emotional standpoint, and spiritual. So I'd like your input on that.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I'm going to give a preliminary response to that. I'm going to save a portion at the beginning and the end of each seminar for us to discuss, so jot down any questions that you have. Okay, we're in lecture mode now. I want to just begin to offer one perspective of that, because this is something that each of you will experience with clients and look at helping them deal with issues of anger. In one sense, in the simplest way of thinking about it, anger is the reaction to the recognition of the fiction of our omnipotence. In other words, helplessness. So, if someone is angry, then their assumption isn't working, and they feel helpless, and anger is the counter to that. Think about somebody cuts you off on the freeway, you instantly get enraged or angry, and anger is to reestablish, at least internally, a sense of power, because it's ersatz power. It's the illusion of power to get angry and to have fantasies or to lash out or do whatever. And it temporarily restores a balance, but it depletes energy. So a coaching approach to this is to address the assumption or the belief that generates the anger. If the belief or the assumption is that someone else should respond as if they were an extension of your desire or your interest, then that will absolutely ensure frustration and potentially anger. So a coaching approach to this is to look at the assumptions that we have, to give up or to let go the ones that don't work, that have to do with assuming that someone else would respond as we want them to, because this is never going to work, and it will ensure frustration. So that we let go of what we can't determine, in other words, our circle of concern, and that includes everything from the ozone level to how your partner responds, or to what the president does or doesn't do, to look at our circle of influence, the things that we can actively determine, and that usually ends at the level of our skin. But if we put our energy into what we can determine, we'll be more effective and ultimately happier and be able to reside more in our whole sense of spiritual self. So that's just a beginning answer. That was just, you know, a bird nest on the ground, and I couldn't resist that. So let's get into what we should be talking about now. Welcome to the Art and Science of Coaching Wellness. I'm Dave Kruger. These sessions are recorded. They'll be posted for playback at the site the following day or within 24 hours. So I would suggest downloading and printing the outline of the workbook so you can follow along. It's a fairly detailed outline, so you don't have to take a whole bunch of notes. In our first session, we'll talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. This will parallel the introduction and preface in your workbook. The following three sessions will develop and apply a philosophy and model of coaching wellness that can be used with individuals and groups anywhere in the world. So, I want to speak to you about your wellness story. I encourage you to do the exercises and work pages in the workbook to parallel my discussion. Then you'll know firsthand how to coach a new wellness story. Although we'll discuss application to wellness, you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and success. In other words, to whatever story you apply it to in addition to wellness story. Life story, career story, relationship story, money story. Why you? You're professionals who know how to listen and guide people. You're change experts and choice architects. You know that intentions need a strategy and a plan. You will learn a proven system of transformation for lasting change. Roadmap is the acronym for the 7 steps to create a new wellness story. It's a master plan to guide you to empowered wellness in your own life, including tools and exercises. Then you can coach it. So, what is the need for wellness coaching? You've seen what I believe are some compelling statistics in the workbook preface. Here's my belief. People don't need more advice about vitamins or told again to exercise or lose weight or stop smoking. They often don't do what they're told, even when they pay to be told. When people consult a physician, they're in pain, they're motivated by being scared, they have to drive across town and park and wait and do the same and schlep back home. What percentage of people follow the physician's advice? Here's a metric. When a physician prescribes a specific medication for the problem that the patient has indicated, slightly less than 50% of people fill the prescription. Of those who fill this prescription, slightly less than 50% take it according to recommendation. So less than 25% of people actually follow through even when they consult an expert. What's missing? They need to make wellness their own story, to own it. It's the physician's story, the consultant's story, and not the patient's yet. People need a clear, specific, stepwise program for change and an informed guide to help them. They need an accountability partner who's an expert at change. It's exactly what each of us are. The mission of wellness coaching is to help people establish healthier lifestyles, to write their wellness stories and incorporate that either as a central focus or as a component of what we do with them. In addition to individuals interested in health and longevity, who needs wellness coaching? The answer, any business interested in achieving these goals. Reducing medical claims, lowering stress, reducing absenteeism, improving morale, improving retention rates, generate overall savings to the organization. So what's the scope of wellness coaching? In addition to individual and group coaching, examples of some of the portals of entry, the gatekeepers for wellness coaching include human resource heads and groups, employee assistance programs, healthcare insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, small business owners, school systems, and government agencies, especially ones that are self-insured. Natural affiliates include fitness trainers and clubs, nutritionists, holistic care providers, healthcare providers, consortiums of wellness practitioners. Now, let's move to application. Why is change so difficult? In studies of coronary bypass patients, when their lives are at risk, unless they adopt healthier lifestyles, how many do you think change their habits? Only 1 in 9. It took Ignaz Semmelweis more than 20 years to persuade doctors that washing their hands could save the lives of mothers giving birth. He had the data, the proof, but that wasn't enough to change minds. He died before people believed and changed. Changing behavior is difficult. What keeps people from doing what they need to do for themselves? What makes it so difficult to change even when someone's life depends on it? Data shows that driving while texting is more dangerous than driving while drunk. How many people stop doing it because of that? Some of the resistance is staying in a comfort zone of the predictable and the familiar. Another component of resistance is that our brains resist change. They're programmed to operate on the default mode of repetition. So keep this question, why is change so difficult, in mind? We're going to return to it and strategize around it. You have to own your wellness story. The light on the dashboard appears and says service engine now. You go and disconnect it so the light doesn't shine. It creates an artificial sense of satisfaction that nothing's needed. Another term, denial. But once you know something, you can never not know it again. Denial is still a form of engagement. People are afraid to go to the doctor. They aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial will be confronted. Making a physical symptom go away does the same thing. The symptom is the signal, a story in itself, a story needing, begging to be listened to and understood. Your body will simply find another way to bring you more information. Just because you're not sick also doesn't mean that you're healthy. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. That's what recognition of writing your own story means, that you create whatever you think and feel and experience each moment. And that whatever you experience, you either create or you accept. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach might be different than if from the beginning you know you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for that car, probably change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing that would be the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you will have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Everything counts. Look later at the addendum on page 6 to see how two little French fries can weigh 40 pounds. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you especially read the Wellness System of Energy in the preface of the workbook, beginning page XII, little 12. It introduces some later discussion on the impact of change on mind and brain. From the teachings of the Tao, the source of spiritual energy is physical, rooted in the base chemistry of the body. Self-cultivation refines this energy for spiritual attainment. Enlightenment is a psychophysiological achievement, a state of being rather than intellectual understanding. Spirituality is an expression of energy. So let's look at new wellness story. We're in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. Now, this has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Of 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others that prompted procrastination. Three areas people know exactly what to do and don't do it. Working out, food, and money. More than anything else, people put off exercise, eating a planned healthy diet, funding their retirement plan. These three areas of life, exercise, nutrition, saving money, are things people know exactly what to do and don't do it. It is not lack of information. What if you treated a task such as exercise with the same mindset as work? Or perhaps suggest to your client to consider this. With work, you don't have to get up each day and debate about whether you will or won't work, whether you'll take off a couple of days, or just skip it, or bargain with yourself that you're going to start next Tuesday, or feel virtuous if you do. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate it. In school, later in work, you show up. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. You do not have to debate about it. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, including full-time parenting. I grew up on a farm and ranch. Every morning before school, I fed the cattle, same every evening. It was a given. No questions asked. Age 8 on, morning, evening, 7 days a week, cattle had to eat. My dad helped me make it my story. It stopped being work when some of them were my cattle. But consider how exercise can be the same mindset, the default story. Something that you do each day, but it needs a plan and a commitment just like your business. That's why people need coaches. Biologically, your body only knows two things, growth or decay. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr. is an internist in New York City who's devoted over 35 years of his professional life to wellness research. And his book, Younger Next Year, a companion book, Younger Next Year for Women, says that 70% of aging is not aging but decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and each bathe cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. Recent research at the University of Vermont showed that even moderate physical activity improves mood up to 12 hours after the activity. Dr. Christian Werner in Hamburg summarized his institute's findings in one simple sentence. Exercise at the molecular level has anti-aging effects. Now, we're going to look at the process of change in an informed and a systematic way. First, I want to provide some context and stimulus for you to actively work on the exercises and quizzes in the workbook for each of the 7 steps. The composite will provide a template, a roadmap, to guide and apply your wellness story. First, let's look at the power of story. Write this question down. What is my story? At a time maybe you schedule a brainstorming time for yourself, think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Bullet your major storylines. Now, your story is not your bio, your title, your role, your credentials. It's your plot. Then write this question. What is my wellness story? And again, consider making an appointment with yourself to brainstorm these 2 questions and truly reflect. So, here are some premises that our work together will be based on. These are in your outline. 1, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the outline of life narratives, the core assumptions of life stories inform what we look for and how we attribute meaning to what we see and what we experience. 2, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, "You know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story." A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Defense lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, "The world is made up of stories, not atoms." We personify the economy or the stock market as if it were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer relationship or assign causality or ascribe a story with a mind of its own to one of our own creations. My ulcer acted up. My weight gets in the way. 3. We each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and process. The brain needs a story. It will infer one, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. We then create life narratives according to that plot, since mind and brain are both programmed by the default mode to ignore facts that contradict our assumptions. We simply may not register something that we don't believe because we don't see it in attention blindness. 4. A life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions tell us what to look for and how to perceive and process experiences. We have to believe in order to see. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. An example, Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently the Broadway hit Wicked, said this, "I didn't even realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent." Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. After his 23rd book, he became consciously aware of what he just described to say, "You know, I just realized I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, the mother's still there, what's the problem? There's nothing to write about." 5. We believe and remember only that which fits our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. For example, somebody abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships, even though circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by the narrative plot. 6. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an example. This happened a number of years ago out of Oxford. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They didn't communicate with themselves. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, and education. Two anthropologists lived for a year and then emerged to compare notes. They expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a unity and a comfort, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never reached a harmony. The anthropologist could not understand the discrepant results or find any reason. They and their teams puzzled for months, until finally they found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist, who had no gun, had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And he achieved remarkable unity with the ape colony. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. 7, a story can define possibility. You guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. Then in 1954, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Within the following 18 months, a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what is possible changes, reality changes as well. 8. A story can actually define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient's prescribed an inert pill plus a story, some expectations. In the majority of cases, the story becomes the reality. By anticipating experience, we can create it. In fact, the story generates a truth so powerful it can even reverse, in most cases, the actual pharmacological effect of a real medicine. The placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that becomes a truth. In fact, a recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo worked significantly better than a much cheaper one. Same placebo, different stories. And this isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. And in a related way, medical research suggests that just over 70% of successful non-surgical treatments are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work, which, of course, is predicated on the physician's belief that the treatment will work that gets conveyed to the patient. 9. A story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates is perceived to act on its creator and make the creator a victim rather than recognizing the creator as the author. Here are some of the ways that we can see ourselves as the victims of the stories that we create rather than the author. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. This is why, as a kind of a sidebar comment, this is why when I began work with each client in mentor coaching, I request permission to interrupt them at any time. And I also want to give them permission to interrupt me at any time, because any time an expression like this is used, I want to get it while it's hot off the press. I want to stop and look at and examine what they just said as a way of constructing their story that may be limiting. Another example of the power of story is a woman I knew who recalled an incident from her adolescence. She attended a Catholic all-girls boarding school. She said, "At one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked and everybody got drunk." 10. Your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. Everyone is always making self-statements, so don't take it personally. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves, to make themselves feel better, what they want or don't want to own, what they disavow or project. 11. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion, so to speak. This observation came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. 11, and this is huge, and listen carefully to this. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. This comes from neuroscience. Good parents have known it for centuries. It's something that I believe is a parallel, one of the many parallels, that the very best thing that we can do for our children is the very best thing that we can do for our clients, to believe in them, and they'll both teach us why. Now, let's return to that question about the difficulty of change. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? And this was a question, this is going to begin to get to Megan's question about clients who have a story, it doesn't work, but they keep doing the old story, or they don't focus on anything other than the negativity. Why do we resist change? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result? Kind of like somebody who doesn't speak English, you repeat English louder, like louder English is going to work and somehow tip the threshold. Even when it leads to lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So here's a two-part answer. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. That's how our software has been revised. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that is synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. And we're going to return to this because this is the last step of the roadmap, program new identity. The most common reason that people don't change is they don't incorporate the change into the operating model of themselves, their identity. They see it as a behavior and then revert back to who they see themselves as they really are. So let's do a brief exercise. If you can, get your both of your hands free. Put your palms together right in front of your face and interlock your fingers very firmly. Your fingers and thumbs, interlock them very, very firmly. Notice when your hands are clasped together, which thumb is on top. Now, keep everything you're saying the same. Keep your fingers exactly as they are, but change so the other thumb is on top. How does that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now, stay clasped, but move your thumb back to the original position. That's the way it ought to be. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, major transition, really out of the comfort zone. We're going to talk later about comfort zones and how to program change. There is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. That is a dialectic always present with every client, every moment, because you're talking about change. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases, even a little, it immediately sends an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute to this process. We have a comfort zone with everything we do. Once we do something in a repeated way, our brain creates new neurons and neuronal pathways to make it the automatic mode, the default mode, so we don't have to think about it, use energy. We return to the familiar even if we don't like it, even when it's uncomfortable. We have a comfort zone with our weight, with what we eat, with our interactive patterns with people. A comfort zone is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices, what you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program. And remember this, a habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He was a curious little scientific guy, even as well. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its circuitous route. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. No matter how many twists and turns, and he increasingly did this in a diabolical way with new snow starts, each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, by early attachment patterns, by early behavior patterns, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says when we try something new, this isn't normal. It activates that error detection mechanism to alert us to the discomfort of this isn't what's expected. Now, we'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system in a later seminar. So, listen for the power of story. Your brain can rewire. New experiences practiced consistently form new neural pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains as well. Metaphors and narratives actually become brain structures. Also from the Black Swan, ideas come and go, stories stay. So, let's talk about active choice, since I mentioned that besides change experts, we are choice architects. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behavior, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about business, talk about sports. They would choose one of these and behaved accordingly for an entire day. So an introverted person perhaps would choose extrovert and act like an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they ate something that they would have never eaten before and read something that they would never have read before. So after 4 months, what do you think was the biggest change in this group? Think about all kinds of changes. The remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, they almost all kept the weight off and continued to lose weight. Now, this was kind of puzzling to me. This wasn't a diet, but a focus study on change and its impact. The rationale? When people began to change routine behavior, they began to think about decisions rather than habitually choosing the default mode without consideration. They became aware of everything they ate as a choice. They even became aware that each bite was a choice. So they began to ask themselves, is this bite in my best interest? They became aware that every piece of behavior was something that they choose. Once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can consciously decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. Think about this is exactly what we do in mentor coaching. We are catalysts to help people come to recognize and reflect on the components of their story and to systematically examine them with us. So, here then I want to conclude with some principles of facilitating change. We're going to apply all of this in a very practical way in the next three seminars. Here are some principles that focus on facilitating change, which is preface, in my view, to writing a new wellness story. One, each person's life and wellness story is created. In adulthood, you create whatever you think, feel, and experience each moment. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on it, even though it seems to the individual to be just the way things are. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Three, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. This establishes the beginning of a sense of effectiveness and mastery. The antithesis is somebody tells you what to do. The physician prescribes a medication. And we'll talk in a later session how our brain lights up in three different parts when we have an aha moment, a moment of insight, when we're given directives, information, advice, orders. No part of the brain lights up. When that aha moment occurs and the brain lights up, we're vaulted into a state of mind that is more integrative, creative, and synthetic. Four, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. We're most successful when we learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. Five, small changes lead to big changes. We know this in coaching. This is some of the bread and butter of what we're taught in fundamental coaching. Issues that seem large and insurmountable may be approached at looking at the simplicity of the issue to shrink the change to the next step. The focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. We do this with each coaching session. What would you like us to focus on during the session, and what would you like to walk away with? Related to the two questions that I sent around and asked you at the beginning of the seminar. Six, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. And correlation is not the same as causality. To resolve a problem, even emotionally, to come to the end of the past does not create a blueprint for success. That's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees out there. Strategic plans for specific goals are necessary. If something is totally a new experience, you may need a guide, even for something like a healthier diet or exercise. Seven, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what is not will become evident and self-perpetuate. I mean, think about that. That's the simplest way we can say what we do in coaching. If something works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. Eight, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. The end should be in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take, she asked. Where do you want to go? Responded the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. Nine, you need the correct paradigm. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory, not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. A dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. Here's an example. We need to be afraid of the right thing. Smokers who are afraid of flying, average across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Average across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. Or people fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime, more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. And 10, decide what you want. Believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception. A belief is the mind's command to the brain, the software that drives behavior. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on or off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are determined by what we allow ourselves to see and believe. Okay, we have just about 5 minutes. If you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in any thoughts or questions or reflections you have or any clarifications about what we've talked about.
Hi, this is Miriam.
Yeah,
hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is just a technical thing. That high-pitched sound was there throughout the hour, and I called in on another phone, and it was the same thing, and I'm not on a cell phone or a computer phone, so I was wondering if you could just address that for the next class.
I will check with the Telebridge group and see what's happening. Thank you for checking on that and mentioning it. I apologize for that.
Okay. I'm wondering if anybody else is experiencing that, too. I know.
My name is Jesse, and I noticed the buzzing sound more when Dave was talking, but when you were talking just now, it wasn't there.
Oh, okay.
I don't know about anybody else, but I heard it when he was talking, but it seems like
I don't hear it when you were talking either. That's interesting.
Okay.
I have the same experience.
Okay, I'll check on that. Sorry for the technical glitch. Thoughts or questions or reflections on what you heard and what you'd like to discuss?
Oh, hi, this is Lee. I just wanted to
say
hello. I just joined the class. I was about a half an hour late. And I just wanted to say I'm here. As usual, I'm learning a lot and will continue to do so. And for me, by the way, the same thing happened, except I did not hear a high-pitched sound at any point. It's been a sort of a low drone all the time.
Okay. The recording should be up within 24 hours, certainly sometime, probably by noon tomorrow, for online playback at the link that I sent around, the email, the link that you got when you signed up, so that you can revisit anything you may have missed. Any other questions or thoughts that relate to what we've talked about, or just clarifications? Is this making sense to you so far? Remember when we talked. Go ahead.
What was the first question that you wanted us to send you in the email? If we were to sit down.
If we were to sit down face to face, what's the most important question that you have about this topic? You'll see it in the email. And the second question, 4 weeks from now, you would walk away saying this is one of the best and most valuable seminars you've ever attended. What would you walk away with?
Got it.
Dave, this is Megan.
Please.
I have a question. When you talk about, your client would create their plot, you're talking about being the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. Would they consider this, what would be an example of somebody's plot?
Well, okay, I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to elaborate on that. When I talk about listening for what a patient, what someone talks about, in terms of their experience. They may patiently go about explaining their situation. We're thinking of it as a story. That's our metaphor. That's our organizer, because it can help us make sense of things, understand some things, and talk about it. But for the client, it's not a story. It's just the way things are. So this is simply a way that we're organizing and thinking about, so that the last example of what I just heard from a client I'm working with in some you know, major business transition that he's doing. We spoke just very briefly about a pattern that he's recognized in his personal life that parallels some aspects of business that he has pursued only unavailable women. So this is a pattern, an attachment pattern that he recognizes, and he's recognized out of some of our focus on looking at how he's constructing his business story, that this became apparent to him, and that we looked at how show me an obstacle, I'll show you a desire, and how his desire was given safety and a green light only if someone's unavailable, because he's really kind of scared about intimacy and scared of making a mistake in that regard. And it came up because there are some parallel aspects. He's in a multi-million dollar business venture right now, and proposal, and a lot of things are being crystallized that we're actively working on, and he's seeing the parallel in his private life. So moving ahead helps us to recognize some things that we wouldn't see if we were just sitting still. So that's an example of a pattern, but it's a pattern as we're thinking about it, and we want to think about talking about it in a way that it will illuminate something for a client and be helpful to a client to help them recognize something that they may not have previously thought about. Does that make sense as an example of your question, Megan?
Yes, it does.
Okay. All right. Terrific. Well, we're out of time. Thank you all very much for your input and for the interaction that you have. It really brings it alive. I look forward to picking you up right here next time. Thank you very, very much.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Bye. Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you.